to celebrate the life of screen actor Sidney Poitier, we are re-releasing Sneakers this week. Partly because it's one of our all-time fave movies, and partly because In the Heat of the Night is not available except if you subscribe to Cinemax, which we'll eventually get to In the Heat of the Night. Sorry, Lindsay. But for now, Sneakers is what you're going to get. So enjoy.
Also, it is the bonus of us all being in the same room when it was recorded.
And Drew pointed out the other bonus to me earlier today.
It's 6.5 years old.
Yeah, so perhaps, I don't know, I'll be making some Hillary Clinton jokes or some crazy bullshit, or I might inappropriately say the G word before that word was canceled or whatever.
I think also that I would be on Voice 1.0 at that point.
Oh, true. Yeah.
I think.
I think we also had a guest, right?
Yeah, I think Dr. Wonders.
Yeah, so enjoy this re-release of Sneakers.
My name is Eric. And this is our podcast.
Not in the creepy way.
That's my everlasting memory of that film. Not the film, but my ass getting blistered from the seat.
Awkward. I did not see that kind.
Oh, come on.
That's okay. I like this podcast.
I was both impressed and embarrassed.
Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Drew.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Travis.
And tonight, we're going to talk about the 1992 caper film, Sneakers, directed by Phil Alden Robinson. So what do we know about Mr. Robinson?
I don't know anything.
Yeah, me neither.
Awesome. Okay, cool.
Well, before we start off, can I just comment how weird and awkward it is to all be in the same room recording this?
Absolutely. I'm not going to look at anybody when I talk, just so you know.
Really? I'm actually looking right at you.
Oh, that's fine, but I'm not going to look back.
Gotcha. It's fair. I've never done this with another person in the room, so.
Phrasing.
All right.
Okay. So, let's see.
Wait, I lied. I'm sorry. I did have some housekeeping.
Okay.
We need a sound effect, by the way. Housekeeping!
Yeah.
Okay, you know, actually, hold on. Before you even do that, everybody has suggested we have some sort of opening, like a standard opening every time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So let's just do a doo-wop thing right now.
Oh, no.
Boom, boop, boop, boop. No. Yeah. Not too much. Okay.
No, keep going. That started out great.
We'll be the silent backing band.
Oh. Wait, I had housekeeping.
Okay.
Watching this movie reminded me that there's a really small but great and important part played by Stephen Tobolowsky. I was wondering if any of you had listened to his podcast, The Tobolowsky Files.
I have not. I'm not. Who is he in the movie?
He was the doctor.
The
Janek?
No, the bald dude, the employee that they romanced.
He's the one that had the date with Liz.
Werner Brandis.
Yes. I always remember him as like the rapey landlord from Single White Female.
See, I remember him from the insurance agent in Groundhog Day.
Yes. So, yeah, he's a great character actor, and he has a podcast that, Eric, I think you would really dig, because it's sort of him telling stories. It's very much of a storytelling podcast. He has an idea, and he sort of wraps a story around it. Sometimes he talks about his personal life. A lot of times he talks about his time in the entertainment industry, but it's always around some sort of central idea he has. And it really reminds me of the old, like, Herb Shanlin type, like a modern take on that type of storytelling.
Is it like a Spalding Gray thing, or we don't know about Spalding Gray still?
I don't know, but I would guess.
Well, he actually has a pretty good series of quotes about this movie.
He who?
He, Stephen Tobolowsky.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we can get to that later, actually, when we get to well, no, we're talking about it now, so we'll just do it now.
We don't have to talk about it now. That was just my one piece of housekeeping is you guys should check out the Tobolowsky Files, the podcast.
Excellent. Okay. I will put it in the notes as well.
I'm writing it down.
Excellent. Yeah, because nobody can see us doing this. We have to describe all the action.
It's theater of the air.
And I have to try not to nod when in agreement. Instead, I'll say my normal exactly or absolutely, which I'm tired of hearing myself say, but
I know I've done the same thing. As I listen, I'm like, I say that way too much. I need to find a different adjective or a different verb because
exactly. But then the problem with that is then I start thinking about it and that's not good.
No, I started just bringing thesaurus.com up on my laptop when it was just that way there's alternatives constantly.
Anyway, well, actually, since we might as well say it out loud, instead of having people on the phone, now we have actually four people in the room together. So that's kind of cool. Maybe it'll change the sound quality dramatically. We'll find out.
Well, at least for 1 week, briefly.
1 week. We got 3 weeks of you being here, right?
That's true. That's
yeah. True. So I'm going to try to cram as many as I can get in those 3 weeks.
Phrasing.
Yeah. Not in a creepy way.
Can we kill the pool light? I'm already getting warm.
Yeah, we can kill all the lights. All
right.
Not in a creepy way.
I will excuse myself momentarily.
Okay.
One moment.
I appreciate it. I'd do it, but there's a giant tub in the way.
A bathtub. An actual bathtub.
Yes.
And also a chop saw.
So we are recording this in the downstairs of our childhood home. It's kind of interesting to see how it's been. I guess it's unfair to say it's been bastardized by our parents as they're empty nesters now, but they've really taken over what used to be our space.
Oh, yeah. They probably always thought of it as their space, but that was clearly not the case.
Yeah.
But well, I don't know. I mean, my bedroom got turned into the Blue Cortez room, so.
At least your bedroom's still a bedroom.
Well, this is true. My bedroom is the only bedroom that remains, so I guess I was the favorite child.
Something like that.
There's still a bed in there, so except that, you know, now it's the access port to the sewer, so.
I don't know about that, but I do know that Travis is sitting in front of a bottle marked cat urine.
It's true. It's a spray bottle, nonetheless.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cat urine destroyer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. I can't see the destroyer part.
Yeah. Wow. And to be fair, there's no cats currently, so.
Yeah, that's true. We're sitting around all these cat litter boxes, cat litter stuff, and they have no cats anymore.
It's so sad.
Well, we cling to things sometimes for comfort.
Cling to cat litter, I suppose, if we want to.
Super crunchy.
Yeah.
Extra absorbent.
Turns into a gel. It's crazy.
Is it the clumping kind?
Yeah, definitely. It's the clumping kind.
Okay.
I really like the clumping kind. Who would want non-clumping cat litter? Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about Sneakers, the 1992 caper film, directed by Phil Alden Robinson. He wrote Rhinestone, All of Me, Field of Dreams.
Wait, Rhinestone? Like Dolly Parton Rhinestone?
And Sylvester Stallone.
Wow.
All of Me, Steve Martin, and Lily Tomlin.
See, that was a great movie.
Wow, yeah.
Fix Bowl.
And Field of Dreams.
Oh, Field of Dreams. Not a horrible Kevin Costner movie.
No, he directed Field of Dreams. He directed The Sum of All Fears.
Oh.
And, of course, Sneakers. And he's known for frequently casting James Earl Jones, who also made an appearance in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fun.
Too brief an appearance. Would have liked to see more of him. But
mm-hmm.
So any thoughts before we get to the plot of the movie? And we'll just run on through?
I thought this movie has one of the best jazzy openings of a movie, of a modern movie, that really has just indirectly jazz. The jazz is just kind of thrown in for emphasis. Because a majority of the soundtrack of this film is a score that's by, I think, of course, I'm going to forget his name, Marsalis.
Brandon Winton.
See, I'm just failing.
The other one?
The other one, yeah. But which I actually own the soundtrack. Which
Jenny Marsalis?
I own the symphonic soundtrack, which is fantastic because it doesn't contain any of the actual music tracks. It's just all of the symphony from the.
Yeah, the score. Movie,
which is fantastic. So
yeah, well, and I like the anagram, the way they do the anagrams in the opening titles. I think that's fun.
Yeah, that's very witty.
It's it brought me right back once I saw the anagrams. I thought, oh, I remember this movie.
Yeah. Well, and I can spout the anagrams from the later on in the Scrabble game. Like, yeah. I think I quoted them all in the car the other day. So
I was thinking about doing anagrams for the beginning of the show. But then I realized, and since we all have the same last name except for Travis, that it would just be pretty boring.
Well, that, and it's hard to do that visually on a podcast.
Well, but we could have pulled it off had we pulled off the first part.
Oh, okay.
I'm confident saying that had we pulled off the first part, all the rest of it would have been easy. Okay. Since I don't have to prove it, it doesn't really matter, does it?
Did the three of us see this in the theater together?
We may have.
I think so. When did you see this first, Travis?
I think Jason showed it to me years ago, but I clearly didn't pay attention to it because there was a lot of it that I missed. It was kind of like watching a new movie this time.
I think I made him watch it against his will, and he just kind of humored me.
Yeah.
Does everybody have happy thoughts of the movie?
I liked it.
I mean, my thought of the movie as a whole is that to me, it's clear that they had a lot of fun making the movie. It seemed to be that they had a lot of fun working together because there seemed to be a lot of good rapport between the actors. Because Robert Redford has some very good visual acuity in this movie where he's making eye contact with emphasis repeatedly, especially at Timothy Busfield, who plays one of the agents.
All these guys are great. In fact, I mean, this is a movie on your...
The list of judgment.
It just makes me happy to push that button, that's all.
And now I can hear it, so it's just for...
Well, I've never had the ability to just hit a button before. It's always been something I'd drop in after.
I doubt that very much.
Oh, I hit a lot of buttons, but not when I'm on the phone with you guys. That'd be creepy.
This movie for me was it's a weird sort of generational introduction to me of a lot of really big movie stars that I would go back as I got older and revisit some of their older movies. So this is really the first Robert Redford movie that I remember like really enjoying, knowing it was a Robert Redford vehicle. Same with Sidney Poitier. I think the only other movie I'd seen him in up till now was Shoot to Kill. Another movie I saw in the theater, which I thought was great, but may not have been a fantastic representation of his acting talent. Yeah.
What is Shoot to Kill?
You haven't seen Shoot to Kill?
I don't remember what it is.
You've seen Shoot to Kill because we saw it in the theater together.
Okay. Well, while you were clearly too young.
Most likely. Shoot to Kill was a movie about an FBI agent, I believe, who was tracking I don't remember if he's a serial killer or just like a major criminal. And he ended up kidnapping a mountain guide. The criminal ended up kidnapping a mountain guide. And so Sidney Poitier, the FBI agent, had to go track him down with the help of the female mountain guide's, I think, estranged husband or boyfriend, played by Tom Berenger. So sort of a fish out of water movie as the city FBI agent had to go traipsing through the mountains after the criminal and the damsel in distress, played by Kirstie Alley.
Oh, wow.
No, it wasn't her. It was
It was Kirstie Alley.
Was it her?
Yeah.
I don't remember this movie at all. I'm getting super, super old. I mean, I remember Tom Berenger definitely had a period. It was the Berenger period where he's in a lot of stuff, but I'm not sure what he's done since.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
I believe the bad guy was also the bad guy from Highlander.
Our research department? Have we checked with our research department?
Well, I'm looking at the IMDb listing, and so...
Is it like 1987, 1989?
1988.
Wow, good job.
Clancy Brown is Steve. So I'm trying to see what he looks like. I don't recognize him, so...
A guy named Clancy was probably happy to play a guy named Steve.
Yeah. But 1980, Kirstie Alley. So you were correct. Yeah, I remember seeing it, but I don't remember anything about the movie.
Okay. I got nothing. And this to me in my head is starting to sound a little bit like Sweaty Ball. So shall we move on to the plot then?
So just to interrupt briefly, Branford Marsalis.
Branford Marsalis, exactly. I think I called him Brandon, but that's okay. I'm my mother's child. James Woods. James Wood, Tiger Wood, I don't know, got nothing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. All this stuff comes out. It's fine. I can fix it all in post. Not a problem.
The sound of a joke dying.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we have a plot. And
that's what makes it a high quality movie.
Well, the movie starts with, a flashback sequence, which I think was pretty well done. Although, I think the character that later becomes the Cosmo character didn't quite match the Martin character as much.
Yeah, well, we start out in 1969 with Martin Bryce and Cosmo, whose last name we have never found out. And they're hackers, and they're in some sort of university computer center.
Research lab.
And they're basically plotting to do their form of protest, which is redistributing conservative funds to various liberal causes. And did you recognize the guy who played Martin, who's the young version of Robert Redford?
I didn't. He looks very familiar, but I couldn't place him. He is.
I recognize him as the sleazy crematorium guy from 6 Feet Under.
Okay. He was also Mike Nelson in Twin Peaks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, his name is Gary Hershberger.
All right.
The guy who played Cosmo, don't know. Didn't even bother to write down his name because he wasn't anything.
I've seen him in other things, but he's so, like, just nondescript that...
Yeah.
He's an Alfred Molina type.
Alfred Molina type. That's actually pretty hilarious. Anyway, so they're hackers and activists and whatever, and...
I think the term would be hacktivist.
Well, now it would be, but back then, they were just long-haired hippie freaks who were probably in college to avoid the draft. Pinkos. And, so Martin and Cosmo, and they flip a coin to see who goes and gets pizza, and Martin loses, so he's got to go get pizza, and then... Yeah,
but Martin loses at the cheating of the Cosmo character, which is later on a point of contention, because I'm like, you can't be bitter when you cheated and lost, and then you got screwed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my question for you guys. He cheated, right?
Yeah, he cheated.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Because
you can't trust anybody these days. Like, okay, well, guess what? Karma, bitch. You got arrested.
That should have been the title of this movie.
Karma, bitch, you got
karma
arrested.
Bitch. No, just karma, bitch. Karma, bitch. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so while Martin's going to get pizza, he sees the police arrive in a really dramatic fashion, and they go in and bust Cosmo, and Cosmo goes to jail, and Martin's on the run. Flash to present day. And now we have Martin, who is Robert Redford, who plays Martin Bishop, and he's running a... what Wikipedia called a tiger team of security specialists in San Francisco.
Is that really the term, a tiger team?
Apparently. It's a tiger team that goes and checks your probes. Yeah, they probe you.
Rawr.
They probe your security. Exactly. Yeah. Actually, that wasn't good at all.
Yeah.
No.
No, you should try that again.
Yeah, I should. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a little more phlegm next time.
No, I'm not Jewish. I wasn't trying to speak Yiddish.
Actually sounds better if you do the arm motion, even though nobody can see it. I'm serious. You should try it.
See, all of us in the same room is a little destructive.
Yeah, sometimes. This is why we do this over the phone. Because
so yeah, no. So we end up with them all in their newest investigation, their newest client. Who you get introduced, you basically get introduced to all the characters kind of in a roundabout fashion. You know, you get the blind David Shatharian who plays, you know, Whistler, and Dan Aykroyd, who is the crazy, conspiracy theorist, alien abduction wannabe, Whitley Strieber, come lately, who is Mother. And then you get the Carl character, who is the way over eager action kid. And then you get...
Wait, who plays that? Or who plays Carl?
I always forget his name. The Phoenix boy who's dead.
River.
River, yeah. Phoenix.
Yeah, the introduction of Carl was great because it was a wordless introduction of him coming across... He put on a bunch of face paint to darken his face, seemingly for camouflage. And then the ex-CIA agent comes up to him and sees him and just... shakes his head like a disapproving father, and without any words, it really tells you so much history between those two characters. It was a really great job in introducing the whole team, that quick little mini heist.
Well, and I think that was one of the things about the movie is there's so many unspoken interactions in the characters that there's so many just kind of like where they just make eye contact and there's all body language, but there's no dialogue except you get volumes of information. And I think that's the one thing that was fun about the movie, which is why I think that my opinion is that the actors clearly had some kind of chemistry or some kind of friendship because they looked like a fun movie to make, at least in my estimation. Although I think Sidney Poitier was a little overacted and I think there was a little overacting on his part.
Well, by the way, Sidney Poitier was the CIA, former CIA priest. Officer. And what's funny, because what you saw as the disapproving father figure, I saw as Sidney Poitier accusing River Phoenix of being in blackface.
Blackface, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I got too. So, and then, you know, and so they're, that's, you're introduced to all the characters and they're basically breaking into a bank, which is one of the best and funniest parts of the movie to me in the beginning, is when they're all running for the counter and, you know, River Phoenix, the Carl character, just leaps over the counter, and Barbara Redford, the Martin character, goes for the counter and then just hits the counter, like just bam, which is, I imagine how that I would be in real life at this point. I would go for the counter and just hit the counter.
It also leads us into what kind of movie we're facing. I mean, what kind of movie we're in for. I think part of the criticism that this movie got from critics, they remember Robert Redford in like 3 Days of the Condor, or like real espionage or spy type movies. And this is clearly not that. This is fun. This is just a fun romp, if you will.
Yeah, it's definitely light, but you know, it's just enjoyable. You know, it doesn't make you do too much heavy lifting to get through the movie.
Yeah, there's just enough of the espionage thrown in just to keep the story kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But that espionage is kind of incidental to the rest of the story unfolding, because it's really just a story about two friends.
Well, arguably about two friends and then five friends.
Well, but the
and two, a girl.
The struggle of the two friends is basically, because that's the...
Oh, wait, don't forget the governments.
Of course, the governments, yes.
And there's other girls, too.
Well, I don't know. Are there other girls? Yeah, I suppose at the very end, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
You mentioned three days of the Condor.
Yes.
Did anybody else get the feeling that this could be the same character, just, you know, further along in his life?
Absolutely, yeah. So after their initial, our introduction to them as being capable of all this bad stuff, but not actually being bad guys, then Martin is approached by some National Security Agency officers, Dick Gordon, who's Timothy Busfield, and Buddy Wallace, who's Eddie Jones, who confront him with the knowledge of his former identity, and they said that in exchange for clearing his record, they want him to recover this black box from a mathematician who's developed this box under the project name C-Tech Astronomy, supposedly for the Russian government. So Martin doesn't really want to do this job, but he's pretty much forced into it. And then he seeks the help of his former girlfriend, Liz, played by Mary McDonnell. And they go out to get this box, which is disguised as a telephone answering machine, mm-hmm. which dates it just a little bit.
Except I had that very same answering machine. Without the guts, of course, but...
Can one of you explain to me the relationship in this movie between C-Tech Astronomy and Playtronics?
No.
Okay.
In a word.
Okay, good. Okay.
I didn't know.
I feel a little bit better about myself.
I didn't know if there's a connection in the names at all.
Are they the same organization?
No, Playtronics was just the front organization for Cosmos Group. He wanted the Codebreaker, and C-Tech Astronomy was the NSA... The arm of the NSA, because that was just Hunter Janik's cover, because he was being funded by the NSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's what confused me, is that C-Tech Astronomy being the anagram seemed like a clever thing that Cosmo would do, and not something that a giant government agency would do.
Well, see, but it wasn't, because what happened is Janik was working on it, and he named it. It was his project, C-Tech Astronomy. He was being funded, though, by the NSA, because when it turns out later in the movie, spoilers, that he's killed, it turns out that his grant was from the NSA, which is what Kreese revealed, you know, in the newspaper article they're talking about. After the fallout of his of Janik's murder, he's saying, you know, they do the research and it's, oh, you know, he worked for the NSA. His grant was from the NSA. And so it seems like he was a contractor for this project that the NSA wanted funded.
All right. So C-Tech was totally Janik.
I believe so.
Yes, but there was that kind of really weird piece where when you broke the anagram apart, it said too many secrets.
Right.
Except that whenever Cosmos people abducted Robert Redford, he said no more secrets. He actually used the line, like, too many secrets, no more secrets, when abducting him.
Right.
Which implied that not only did he know about it, but he kind of had a hand in it.
Well, but Cosmo knew about it because he knew the box was in motion. He wanted it because his whole goal was to destroy everything. He wanted to have no more secrets. And so it just worked out for him that this project that he had found that was too many secrets fit in with his whole crazy kooky idea that there will be no more ownership.
And did you know that there's an actual, like, NSA team patch that says C-Tech Astronomy?
Did not know that.
Yes. After the movie, they made that because they're funny people, the NSA guys.
Well, and I think we were discussing, we had a couple discussions at the cabin. First of all, part of this movie felt a little bit like Jumpin' Jack Flash in some ways. It's kind of the same era, I think, kind of the same genre of kind of spy comedy thriller thrown all together with some wacky characters.
But is that a bad thing?
No. It was just one observation. The other observation was how prescient this movie was that the NSA was listening to everybody.
Yes.
Well, that couldn't have really surprised very many people.
No, yeah, I agree with that. I just assumed all along that we have been being.
Exactly.
But I think at the time the movie came out, it actually was kind of shocking, you know, because it was, you know, 92?
Yeah.
So, you know, end of the Cold War era. Hopefully the Russians are on the other end of your line, not your own, you know, not Hoover kind of thing.
That's true. I mean, it's shame on us for trusting ourselves.
It kind of had that hacker's feel to it, of that social, you know, idealism about spy on those who spy on us kind of thing.
So the hacktivists of today can look up to Cosmo?
Well, Hackers was only 1995, 96.
It was really funny watching this again 22 years after it came out, realizing how far technology has come and how outdated what was like state-of-the-art technology at the time in this movie has already become. The box in the movie that was going to unlock all the codes in the entire world, or at least America, was a piece of hardware. Where now that just seems like such an outmoded way to get things done. I mean, everything would be done with software now, in the cloud. There'd be no hardware associated with any sort of cryptography breakthrough like it is in this movie. So it was really funny to see.
Well, and then when the Kreese character chucks the cordless phone, the giant cordless phone with the huge metal antenna that he extends, the big telescoping metal antenna that, if anybody ever had one of those, you broke constantly, or bent and tried to bend back and broke anyway. So, nobody really had cell phones. And so, yeah, so in some aspects, the technology of this movie was.
Oh, yeah, no, Robert Redford had a car phone with a cord on the hand, handset, which was awesome.
Wait, I think we have a Toyota Avalon with that same phone.
That's true, yeah. You guys drove one just the other day.
And did anybody catch the piece of Atari hardware that they used during the phone call to the NSA? It was what they cradled the phone in. Yeah. I couldn't tell if that was supposed to be a modem or if that was just a speakerphone attachment.
Those were old school modem connections.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's how you got a modem, is you had the telephone cradle receiver. Mm-hmm. That you plugged the phone into, and had these big rubberized cups that you kind of molded the earpiece and mouthpiece into, except that they didn't have a standard old Ma Bell kind of phone receiver. They had the kind of the newer modern squarish boxy phone receiver. So they just had to kind of set it on.
Yeah. Well, they had the newer ones where instead of the molded cups that those little AT&T handsets fit in, they had more of a rubberized cup that can adapt to anything.
No, before the days where you actually had, you know, before you actually had modems built into things, as your modem was separate. And,
oh, yeah. It was like,
so you'd actually place the receiver on it, and then the box itself would create the screeching noises.
Exactly.
Which
is why it was really slow, because the data, you'd lose a lot of the signal through the loss of the phone signal itself. It would just bleed out of the phone. And if you were standing next to it, it was really loud.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also why David Strathairn's character is named Whistler. He's a phone freak. In fact, they had those boxes of Captain Crunch in the garbage.
Captain Crunch was actually a pretty famous phone freak in the 1980s who developed the ability to make long-distance phone calls for free. And the way that you did it was you dropped change into a phone receiver, usually a payphone, and recorded the tones the coins made as they went through. You could then play that back and make free long-distance phone calls. And actually, do you remember the Anarchist Cookbook back in the day? It actually had the ability and the kind of the manuals on there on how to build those boxes to do phone freaking and those kind of things, which nowadays are completely outdated and you couldn't do anyway. But
well, now it's all digital, but at the time, and you know why Captain Crunch was called Captain Crunch?
I actually don't know that part.
Because Captain Crunch cereal at one point had whistles as the prize, and you could use those whistles to mimic the phone dialing codes and the change code. So you could do it all. In fact, I think he had perfect pitch, so he could just make the sounds too.
That's quite a talent.
Yeah. It's like that talking backward thing in Twin Peaks. It's just bizarre.
Garmambosia.
Yeah. Anyway. You know, it's actually, that's two movies with Formica in it. So, they're all having this party because they actually end up through, I think probably the weakest con in the whole thing was him talking to the Gunter Jannik's girlfriend.
Yeah. And I want to interrupt and point out, so there's a little bit of a continuity error, or the Tiger team wasn't really up to snuff in this, because I noticed this when I watched the movie this time. So they did a stakeout of Jannik's office, and they have all this video footage of him looking at his keyboard and trying to get his password. And you see where he opens the door for Dr. Ryshkov, right?
Who's his girlfriend character. Right.
You see him open the door, and at the point you see him open the door, you very clearly see the doorknob and the keypad. So at that point, you know exactly what kind of doorknob you're coming into, except that later in the movie, they have no idea what kind of keypad door he's going after, because they're kind of, he's doing the lock pick thing in the back of the truck to see if his lock pick skills are up to snuff. And then when he gets up to the door, they're like, uh-oh, does anybody know how to defeat this keypad? Which, again, you would have seen this in all the research, and I saw it already. So it's like, it was one of those, like, fell a little flat. But also the brilliant execution of a solution ever in a movie where, you know, you have the long drawn out, yep. Okay. And then he just kicks the door open, which is, that was that kind of brilliant, like, well, that worked.
No, it's Indiana Jones.
But better, because it's Robert Redford.
Can we talk for a second about Jannik himself?
Sure.
Did anybody recognize him?
I did not.
Donald Logue?
Mm-hmm.
He has been two of my favorite characters ever. The bad guy. One of the bad guys from Blade,
mm-hmm.
is great. But also one of the detectives on the TV show Terriers. Did any of you ever see it?
I'm not sure I've even heard of the Terriers.
Terriers is, you should check it out. It only lasted a season because nobody watched it, but it is a fantastic, sort of buddy PI, television show.
Like Simon and Simon style?
Yeah, sort of. Updated, a little bit darker, but really subversively funny and clever, great dialogue, great chemistry between the two leads.
Is it an American?
Production? Yeah, it's an American. It's it was written by Sean Ryan, along with another guy who I don't remember, but it's great. It's only 13 episodes, so you can really chew through it pretty quickly. But one of my favorite TV shows, probably in the past 10 years.
Okay, Terriers. By the way, just to tangent off slightly, did you guys like Rubicon?
Loved Rubicon. I was really, really bummed it only lasted a season.
Yeah. Have you seen Rubicon?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, okay. Because I really liked it, too.
Rubicon had one of the best speeches about a tie in the history of film.
A tie like two people finishing at the same time, or a tie like a neckwear?
Like a necktie.
Ah, okay. I don't remember the speech, but...
It was when the head of the intelligence company was going before Congress, and he was... I think it was a military general was questioning about why they needed sort of an outside intelligence agency. And he had this whole parable about...
One final thought, if I might. When you left the house this morning wearing that tie... Perhaps your wife stopped you in the doorway. Perhaps she told you how good you looked in that tie, how handsome it was. Now, while I'm sure you love your wife, might I suggest you have many reasons to distrust her judgment about that tie. Maybe she has a fond memory of another time you wore it, a sentimental attachment. Or perhaps she knows your tie collection and she's simply glad you didn't choose one of the ties she dislikes. Perhaps she just sensed you were feeling a little fragile. She felt like bucking you up a bit. Now, imagine for a minute, you sit down here with us, and I say to you how much I admired that tie. instantly you have another opinion, but you don't know me. There's nothing personal between us. We have no sartorial history, no emotional attachment. Whose judgment are you going to trust? Mine? Or your wife's? The gentleman to my right is a remarkable intelligence analyst. He is skilled in pattern recognition, systems analysis, emergence theories, but in truth, his greatest asset for you is that you don't know him. And he doesn't know you. He doesn't care about you or your feelings. He just knows what your tie looks like. You can trust him.
But yeah, I love that show. It was I already knew that it had been canceled by the time I started watching it. So it was very sad, but I loved it.
I expected the Janet character to have like a lion taming outfit, a la Siegfried and Roy.
There was a little bit of that.
But he could also have been the villain from Contact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he could have been the brother of the Busey character.
So didn't we have we talk about the similar...
In Malice, yeah, we did. So as being Tobin Bell.
Yeah.
Tobin Bell being possibly the father of the Busey character.
That's the dude from Saw?
It's the dude from Saw, yes. The one I referred to in the Malice episode is Weasel-Faced Guy. Because he's always a bad guy, or a redneck, because he's got a weasel face.
I don't think he'll be appearing as a guest after that.
I'd love to have him as a guest. If anybody out there in listener land... Oh, speaking of listener land, a tangent off one a little bit. I don't know, because it happened the day after the celebration of life for our grandmother. It could have been a relative who did this by accident, or we suddenly developed a huge bunch of source code fans, because we got 23 source code downloads in one day.
Oh, wow. That's not possible.
It's just about half of the total before then.
You're terrible people.
Do you think it was just one person listening to the first 7 minutes of it 23 times?
I do. I do, in fact, think it was somebody who was just trying to figure it out and maybe subscribe to the podcast or try to download from maybe several different types of devices. I haven't really investigated that further, that more, but there can't have been. I mean, unless it was mentioned on the source code podcast itself or source code fan page.
I was going to say some kind of fanboy site for source code or Jake Gyllenhaal or.
Yeah, which would have been great, but I don't believe that's the case. So
23.
I know. 23 is already a decent number of downloads per day anyway.
I think 23 is a cry for help. So if you're out there and listening, please email us. We will help you.
But don't stop downloading.
And don't forget to rate us 5 stars.
Exactly.
On iTunes.
Exactly. Yeah, because 4 stars is not going to help anybody. In a very caper-esque fashion. Again, all of these little caper things they do are completely fun. The movie does not take itself very seriously, and everybody seems to be having a good time, so I forgave a lot of the little errors. But so they end up taking the box, and they're having this little party in their office or the flat that one of them lives in or something, and a rousing game of Scrabble is being played.
Well, they're celebrating because the whole point of getting the box was not only was Martin Bishop going to get his name and criminal record cleared so that he could live as himself again, but they're also going to get a pretty decent payday that they're all pretty excited about.
Oh, exactly.
Although in today's standards, not a real big payday.
Yeah.
But in $92, I guess that would have been a fair chunk of change.
Yeah. Well,
it was established pretty early on that they were all struggling for money, so... Yeah. I think they were just happy to get any income.
Yeah, because, I mean, how much work is there for a Tiger team in 92?
As the cashier at the bank noted, it wasn't a very good living.
Yeah, it's kind of mean.
Yeah, she was like the bitchiest bank cashier ever.
Yeah, there were a lot of little one-liners like that, though. But I appreciated that because that kind of set the shadowing for that they were struggling.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you know what? I would not tolerate that in a cashier. I don't want the bank person making... It'd be like the grocery person mocking the stuff I was buying at the store.
And she was very, like, let me get this straight. You break into people's places to make sure that nobody can break into people's places. So she was already kind of out on the edge anyway, kind of intruding on something that wasn't...
Well, that's true. And she was playing Lieutenant Exposition, reporting for duty. Yeah, so...
Yeah, which there was a fair bit of that in this movie, too, though. When you watch it, you see, you know, Mary McDonald did that quite a bit where she says something which is clearly just meant to kind of clarify if anybody wasn't paying attention exactly what's going on.
Well, that's okay. You need some of that.
Right.
It's just, you know, well, some is more clever than others.
I'm not complaining. I like her very much, so.
So during this Scrabble game, where it begins with the argument over whether scrunchie was a word, clearly today scrunchie is a word, although maybe it's a brand name.
Yeah, I think it ends with an I and something you put in your hair.
I think it's actually IE.
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, so.
I got $5 on Y.
Okay, yeah, I get that 10 cents on Pass Me the Pepper. And anyway.
There's the hand motion.
Yeah.
See, it sounded better too.
So
during Scrabble.
Scrunchy, IE, okay. Is a fabric-covered elastic hair tie, or CHY, but the brand is IE.
Okay. Oh, excellent. So scrunchy with the Y is a good Scrabble word, and scrunchy with an IE is not.
I'm going to call that a push.
Scrabble is when they figure out that shit is not right.
Well, that C-Tech astronomy means something, as if you didn't already know it meant something anyway, because they kept parroting it through the movie. But so they end their Scrabble game, which people are cheating anyway, so to figure out exactly what C-Tech astronomy meant, which, you know, gave the plethora of the Monterey's Coast, My Socrates Note, Cootie's Rat Semen.
Cootie's Rat Semen is pretty great.
Well, that one always makes me laugh, even still, because I'm 12.
Well, any kind of semen joke is funny. Rat semen especially so.
I just wouldn't get it in your eye, but...
Well, yeah, I don't want to get any on me.
But then that's where they get, you know, too many secrets, and this
salty.
Is...
Salty.
This is...
Sorry.
Wow.
Yeah, anyway.
That's just not one too far.
Yeah. Well, that's my name is Eric, and that's what I do. I'm sorry.
Not in a creepy way.
Yeah. Well, I'm sitting here looking at this plastic fist. What is that all about?
It's a Nyla bone for dogs.
It looks like a plastic knobby fist.
It's a bone. It's meant to be like a femur.
Okay.
What kind of fist do you have that looks like it? Don't answer that.
Oh, there's no thumb there, but, you know. So.
Wow. Okay. So they're having their
Look, dog toys are not supposed to be Rorschach tests, but they could be. Have you ever seen the whole thing where they have like four dog toys and a sex toy, and you're supposed to guess which one's a sex toy?
What kind of website do you hang out?
We're not here to judge.
Anyway, okay.
Wow. I just came here to talk about movies. I didn't realize we were going to have website commentary. But, all I have to say is penisland.com.
I'm going to put it in the notes. I'm going to put it in the notes. You'll see it. It'll be great. Okay, so back to Scrabble.
So they're playing Scrabble, and simultaneously, while the Scrabble is going on, Whistler asks Carl to help him to kind of poke at the device a little, because he's curious, because he's kind of inquisitive by nature, kind of figure out what's going on with this box that they have, because they want to see what it can really do, which is when they discover that the box is the code breaker. And so there's a scene where they're going to supposedly unhackable websites, which now they can access because this little black box magically transforms everything into a language and a text that they can easily discern on their computer screens. So it is the code breaker is what they discover, which is when they all come to the revelation that this is actually probably a little bit dangerous.
Well, and it was also a really fun anachronism that it seemed like such a wild concept that they could actually dial into these very specific places, you know, before the internet. It was such a wild notion that it was supposed to blow your mind that they could not only call up these places on their computer, but then also break into them using this piece of hardware.
Well, except for the fact that if you listen, he doesn't dial the right number of digits on any phone number he dials. It's either too many or too few.
Okay.
That's just the OCD in me.
I'm guessing it's going to be. what I liked is the fact that it was all green screen technology. It was, you know, before computing became artful.
Well, they had the Power Grid network had kind of a nice little, and the FAA network.
Well, they were all stick drawings, though. It wasn't that dynamic Apple Macintosh kind of thing we've become used to now.
Well, yeah, but it was 92, so it was flashy for the time.
Oh, no, it was fine. And actually, it's what I liked about this scene in particular is that even though it had the old technology, the way they reacted to this information, the ability to do this, is exactly how people would react, I think. You know, you have the hacker guys who were just happy and they're like, hey, we could do this, we could do that. You know, would you like to crash two planes together? And the CIA guy was like, no. Shut it off.
And Bishop was sort of somewhere in the middle. He was really enamored with the ability to do it, but realized pretty quickly how dangerous it was.
Well, yeah, and I think he was kind of evaluating what it all meant. I think that was the point where he was kind of tipping it over in his head as to what was really going on.
Well, and this is what he and Cosmo had been kind of working on back in the day.
And he also remembered after the conversation with the guy from the Russian consulate that they used different codes, and so it was kind of piecing that part together of, like, they use different codes, so this might not be something that the Russians were doing to spy on the Americans.
Yeah, or vice versa.
Right.
Yeah, it was just spying on us.
Because that was the premise of the NSA guys coming to see him, is that mm-hmm. they were worried that the grant was from, the Janus grant was from the Russians. Mm-hmm.
So, and then, Martin goes to hand the box to the NSA officers, but figures out right away, or I guess...
Kreese does.
Yeah, Kreese
figures it out.
Figures out from flipping over a newspaper.
Yeah, which is another, like, anachronism because nobody has a newspaper anymore.
But they find out that Janik has been killed, so they're going to kill Robert Redford as well. So he motions Martin to get out of there. Martin gets out of there, and then they have this sort of car chase kind of thing.
Which is a great little moment, watching him putter around in a car. And they go back to the origin of the NSA, which turns out, oops, surprise, they weren't NSA at all.
Is that his 3 days of the Condor car? It seemed like that vintage.
I think
vintage.
It's very close.
I think they used the same car in So I Married an Axe Murder.
Never seen it.
Yeah, me either, but I've heard it's really good.
It's a great movie.
I've heard it's really good, for real.
But then you have, he decides that he's going to go confront Gregor because he thinks that the Russian has sold him out.
Yeah, and Gregor's a Russian consulate. Or actually, this is just after the fall.
Cultural attaché.
Exactly. This is Russian Federation, not Soviet Union.
Right. And how convenient that Gregor just happens to be plucked in the back row of this entire event.
And somehow Bishop gets a gun into the consulate.
That was the other thing.
Well, there's that, yeah.
Yeah, there's a little bit of you have to suspend your disbelief. But love the little boathouse or whatever it was where they go down into where it's all foggy and murky. And
that's the pool, I believe.
Yeah.
Hotel pool.
I thought it was a pool too, but I'm like, why did they have a pool down there and why weren't the lights on?
Well, yeah, but it was almost like it...
It looked like a creepy Eastern Promises bathhouse.
It could have been, yeah. Actually, that's an excellent point.
It could have been
point.
A bathhouse, yeah.
We narrowly avoided seeing Gregor and Robert Redford have a naked fight. It's been appalling. Have you seen Eastern Promise?
No.
Eastern Promises? Yeah. Amazing.
You didn't make that with that case that you just laid out.
There's naked... Naked
Viggo Mortensen in a very uncomfortable, realistic fight to the death. In a bathhouse.
Brutal, naked fight.
Okay.
Yeah. Very well done, though. Viggo's actually the guy to go to for brutal fights. I mean, like, The History of Violence also has some pretty good Viggo action.
Those are both Cronenberg, right?
Uh-huh. They are. Mm. And there's also a very rough sex scene, too, in History of Violence, which is worth, you know.
But not in a creepy way.
No, it's actually very artistic.
Yeah, way to undersell the History of Violence right there.
No. It's an artful piece of a scene. It's an art scene. But anyway, perhaps we'll take all this out too. Okay, so...
You know, every time you say that, though, never been taken out.
No, I don't want to take out anything if I can help it. Yeah. Are you kidding? Context. If anything, I try when jokes fall flat, I try to add a little extra dead air to it.
Wah, wah.
Do that one more time?
No.
I want to clip it out so we can use this.
Of course you want to isolate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so they go down to the bathhouse and have a little conversation.
And then they end up in the limousine.
Yes.
Where he's going through spy books to figure out who exactly, Robert Redford was dealing with, which Travis made the point, like, why? Well, you should make the point
Which one? I made a lot of points.
When they're in the back of the limousine and they're talking about when
make the best one.
They're really good point.
Yeah. When Martin is trying to find the guy, and he finds the guy who it turns out to be the Buddy Wallace, Buddy Weber
Wallace
guy.
Character.
And then the conversation between Gregor and Martin. And you're like,
yeah, I mean, there was this thing of like, oh, well, you need to leave the country. You know, you disappeared before, disappear again. And he's like, well, who's following me? And rather than just tell him, which really would have been quicker than just this kind of like cloak and dagger stuff, he keeps repeating these things over and over again, like, oh, well, you can't trust anyone. You can't do this. And it would have taken him probably 5 seconds and saved his life. He would have just said, this is who it is. But he wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that was really maddening. It was like having a conversation with my 2-year-old.
Like, just do it. Just say it.
And did we ever find out who this Wallace guy was supposed to be working for that was so spooky?
Well, he worked for Cosmo. I just assume it was C-Tech Astronomy. Or
Playtronics,
yeah.
Yeah, well, he worked for Playtronics, but, you know, then you never quite know if, you know, he works for Playtronics, but was Playtronics really a front for the mob, or was it something bigger?
Well, that's true. We never really did find out where all that led
because
to.
Because would the Russians really be afraid of the American mob?
Right. Or afraid of Playtronics?
Exactly. Because of all the mobs in the, I mean, maybe the Yakuza the Russians might be afraid of, but the American mob, I wouldn't imagine the Russians would be really threatened.
But I don't think it was ever really the mob, because he actually makes a joke when he says, like, organized crime, and he's like, it's not that organized. And it's kind of this, like, catty comment on the side where it's, I didn't really take that to be the mob. I took it more to be, like, some like over-governmental organization.
Right. And I think that, you know, the setup in the room is that the Cosmo character makes the motion to quiet Robert Redford from saying things like they're being listened to. So it's clear that they're being listened to, and who they're being listened to, we don't know. So it may be that Cosmo knows somebody's listening to him from the government, but the mob thing is just Cosmo's cover to what he's really trying to do, which is take over the world.
Well, I've got another problem with the limo scene, though.
Okay.
Here's the problem with it.
Before I forget, I love the characterization that Cosmo's catty, because he really is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some weird stuff going on. Okay, so the limo scene, I was really sort of pissed about this, because it is, we had just talked about how developmentally disabled it was for MI6 to have a hard drive full of agents, like, just laying around where people could take it. Cosmo had a freaking photo album of all these agents flipping through.
Gregor.
I'm sorry, Gregor, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is that all about? And how many of those did you need? What, is it a file cabinet in his limo?
Well, those weren't Russian agents, right? Those were agents those were just his
spy,
his intelligence.
Yeah. Those were people that they had tried to recruit or had recruited.
Yeah. It was nobody that Gregor felt the need to protect their identity.
Yeah, because Gregor pointed out, he said, when Martin picked the picture, he said, Buddy Wallace, Buddy Weber, blah, blah, blah. We tried to recruit him in 90-whatever.
83.
Because he had drinking problems and marital problems and all of this. It were people, you know, they were people they were keeping tabs on, but that they didn't have in their employ that they had thought.
But he drives around with it in his limo?
Well, you know, well, but see, I think the scene, because you don't see them get to the limo scene.
Or maybe he kept it in the bathhouse. It seems like an unlikely place to keep your photo album, what with the humidity.
I don't know. If you're looking at a bunch of steamy guys, I don't know. Maybe that's where you keep all your photo albums of swanky guys. I don't know.
Let's not forget that when someone from a foreign agency says, if you stay in this limo, I can keep you safe. Don't go out there. You need to run. The first thing you shouldn't do is climb over him and get out of the safe place.
That's true. That's a good point.
Well, except that he gave him mixed messages. He's like, get out and run, or no, I can protect him.
I think Bishop was just so pissed that Gregor just wouldn't fucking tell him.
It was a genuine anger. I agree. Because I wanted to throw something at the television.
It was a frustrating moment, to be sure.
So they get pulled over by FBI agents.
Well, purportedly, but turns out not.
Well, no, of course not. And in a really brutal scene, actually.
Yeah, I think the most brutal of the movie.
Yeah, they take Martin's gun, who he should never have gotten into or out of the consulate, and they shoot Gregor.
Right, and the driver.
And the driver, yeah. In the back.
And the driver, by the way, let me point this out, too.
Yeah.
If you're a driver, drive.
Exactly.
Yeah, the FBI agents didn't have him like a roadblock. They could have just hit the gas and gone.
Yeah, exactly. At the point that there was a gunshot, I would have been out of there.
Yeah, you don't get out and run if you're the driver.
Yeah, also, if it's a limousine, the long way for the bullet to travel from the back of the car to the front. You've got pretty good odds you're going to get away.
Yeah, Dimitri, you had one job, drive.
Yeah, and go back to the consulate.
Yeah, anywhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's at the end of the tunnel, wherever else they were. Yeah, it's to the end of the road. Turn right. It didn't matter. Because at least one of the guys was out of the car. He would have either had to leave his buddy. Hey, it would have been a mess.
Yeah, but this was a pretty shocking scene to have, you know, cold-blooded murder sort of out of nowhere in a pretty lighthearted movie up to that point.
Okay, well, we need to have a little blood pack here that if any of us are in the driver's seat of a car when somebody else gets shot, drive. Drive, drive, drive.
I don't think you have to worry about that. We will.
Okay.
We, you know.
If you can't drive forward, drive back into them.
I flee when there's not even firearms involved, when it's a fireplace poker, so.
Yeah, well, it's.
Later in the movie, there's even a blind guy that knows to drive.
Well, exactly. Yeah, okay. So this is an educational program we're doing here. So I'm just telling you, people, if you're in the driver's seat, literally or figuratively, drive.
Yeah, because there's a whole movie about that called Drive, by the way.
Yeah, I never saw it. Any good?
Yes.
Okay. You didn't like it?
Oh, it was so predictable. I knew 20 minutes.
Don't tell the end. No, don't tell the end. We're only spoiling one movie this time. Except for Gwyneth Paltrow's Heads in a Box.
We're talking about the same movie, the Ryan Gosling movie?
Yes. I figured it out 20 minutes in.
That was not a movie about plot at all. That was a movie completely about tone.
Yeah, but it had the violence and then I just, no.
Anyway, so this is the first time, again, and this seems to be a sticking point for me in movies. I don't, maybe, I don't know, because I deal with some traumatic brain injury where I work. People get knocked out by being hit with guns and stuff.
In the face.
So unrealistic.
Well, and that they recover seemingly without any.
Yeah. And maybe you can get knocked out a couple times and not have it be a big deal, you know, a la NFL. But still, it's just it takes me out of the movie a little bit.
Well, and I think the continuity of this movie is hard to discern because it seemingly takes place very quickly in rapid succession. Because at one point, you know, Liz is having the dim sum, which I assume is dinner, but then she's immediately having dinner with Werner in his apartment again. So it's hard to discern the days passing in this movie. You know, they have surveillance at the toy factory. The toy lab or whatever.
Well, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, aren't we?
Not really. I'm just saying it's hard to discern the days of movement. So
getting knocked out like that is definitely a movie trope. You just kind of have to accept.
No,
if you want to talk reality, I mean, like we watched Warrior, a movie about mixed martial arts, and you know, if you watch boxing or mixed martial arts, you get to understand pretty quickly how hard it is to actually knock somebody out. A bonk on the head, tombstone style, seems like it would hurt, but not knock you out.
Right. And if it were hard enough to knock you out, you're probably not going to wake up and be real good about just getting up and going on about your day.
Or being able to have, like, a total recall of every sound you heard as you're in a trunk of a car.
Right. And who carries matches?
Well, it was 92.
Everybody in 1992.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Gregor was smoking indoors, so it's definitely
that's true.
In the 90s, yeah. Yeah, so anyway, so he gets locked in a trunk and taken out to eventually meet Cosmo. So he gets...
This was also my first introduction to Ben Kingsley in the movies.
Oh, really?
Which is... it may have actually been mine, too, but it turns out this is not the best Ben Kingsley performance.
Oh, no.
It may be the most fun.
Yeah, I may have seen him in Gandhi before that, but that would have actually been in school, so I would not have paid any attention.
Yeah. And have we ever determined what accent Ben Kingsley was using?
Well, he slipped in and out of accents. That's what was the problem.
That had to have been a New York mobster accent.
It was New York mobster, but I also read a review where it said, actually, Slate's John Swansburg wrote this piece about how Sneakers was one of his favorite movies ever, but he now has to, when he gives it to people to watch, he has to realize that people might not like it because it's a little bit goofy. But he was like, maybe Ben Kingsley, maybe he was in when he was in prison, he was in a cell with an Australian guy. Because he had this weird accent thing going on.
Nobody here has seen Iron Man 3?
I have not.
He is brilliant in that movie.
Is he the Mandarin?
Yes.
Is that a spoiler?
No.
Okay,
no,
good.
Not at
okay.
all. And do you remember the Mandarin from the comic books?
I do not.
Well, comic book people were really pissed at Shane Black. Iron Man 3 also set during Christmas.
I was going to ask. Yeah, it makes sense, though. Well, now we know. James Earl Jones is with Mr. Robinson here. And what was the guy who was cast in Sorkin movies? The name of that guy?
Oh, Josh Molina?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in every Sorkin vehicle, everything.
I went on the Malice episode, just a tangent again. I went looking for, it turned out to be West Wing, where he used the ice cream scoop line again.
Again.
Yeah. But I couldn't find it to plug it in there.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think Josh actually screamed the ice cream scoop line at one point.
It was either that or it was the chief of staff.
The Leo.
Leo, yes. Yeah.
So Ben Kingsley, so you never saw AI?
Never saw AI.
Or Sexy Beast?
Oh, I've seen all those, but since then. But after.
Oh, I see.
After Sneakers, yeah.
Okay.
Let me see what was
Sexy before. Beast is a great movie.
I have not seen it. Who is it? Sigourney Weaver in that?
No, that was what? Ghost and the Maiden?
Okay. I don't know. I think I... Well, he was in...
That was a hard one to watch.
He was in... Was it The House of, you know, Sand and Fog?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a good one. Anyway, are you looking for something in particular?
No, I'm just looking at Ben Kingsley's IMDb listing. And
does it mention how many times he has a ponytail in his characters?
No, his ponytail does not have its own IMDb listing.
Okay.
So I'm afraid I'm out of ammo there.
Okay, so we end up meeting Cosmo, who now we realize is not... I think the Robert Redford character dropped a line earlier that he had died in prison.
Right, early on in the movie.
Yeah, but...
Did Cosmo ever forgive you? I don't know. He died in prison.
Yeah.
Nobody believed that, right?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. So we find out that, of course, Cosmo's behind this whole thing. He's the one who wants the box, and he's going to use it to destabilize the world's economy, which is sort of funny because you can kind of see 2008 all being engineered by Cosmo. The whole housing crisis and when the financial system sort of almost collapsed.
Yes, except one was real and one was a movie.
Yeah, but
if Cosmo had been successful, there never would have been Fight Club. That was Tyler Durden's whole thing, was to bring down the financial system so that everybody would be the same.
Oh, okay.
He was blowing up all the credit buildings at the end of the movie.
Eric did not like the end of Fight Club. He only liked the beginning of it.
Yeah, it's true. It's not that I didn't like the end of it, but I had to watch it.
I think the quote was, the first half of that movie is good, the back half of that movie is not. That was your quote.
Well, I didn't say not. I just said I didn't like it at first. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll defend it.
Oh, now it's at first.
Yeah.
Okay. I see. Okay.
2001 A Space Odyssey. I'm just saying.
You're a bad man.
Yeah. We've established that.
VHS.
Nightbreed. Wait till the Nightbreed episode comes out later this week. Drew did not like me for that one. Oh, well.
Can't wait.
No, you can't, you know. Again, these things you put on pedestal because you saw them a long time ago, but then you realize we'll have to do Fight Club because I want to watch it again with criticism in mind because I really did like the first part of the movie. Actually, Chuck Palahniuk, I like a lot of the first halves of his novels, but things go a little crazy. Like Choke. I recommend the first 200 pages of Choke highly.
It's a creepy book.
It is a creepy book, but it goes down a weird rabbit hole. Do you agree at the end?
It's Palahniuk.
Well, still.
I mean, it's almost, I don't want to insult him in this way, but I will anyway, but it almost has the, you expect it in that M. Night Shyamalan kind of, you expect the curveball, you expect the twist or the goof that happens somewhere.
Has anybody here read or heard Haunted? Haunted
No.
is like 20 stories. 20 short stories that are all loosely connected. There's a wraparound story or a framing story, but there is some creepy shit in Haunted.
Good to know.
I think the first short story itself, it involves a swimming pool, and it is like body horror. Like, it'll make you retch a little bit as you're reading it or listening to it.
Swimming pool, I'm out.
You have no idea how out you are. It's crazy. Yeah, if you don't like squeaky stuff,
I think Jason knows how out he is.
Yeah.
Well, of course, yeah.
Pretty sure about that.
Jason's kind of out, yeah. There we go.
Yeah. But I'll choose to out myself.
Okay. Anyway. Okay. So, Cosmo needs a box. He needs Martin to give him the box. Go ahead, laugh out loud. It's okay. You don't have to stifle laughter.
No.
Not anybody else want to drive this boat or car?
No, we're
or...
just saying, you know, the emphasis that Cosmo needed a box. So.
Oh, okay. You guys, you are 12.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so Cosmo needed this box.
He needed an answering machine, clearly.
Okay.
He's been in prison a long time. The guy needs a box, okay? Jeez.
A box at a room that's at 98.6 degrees.
Exactly. Yeah.
Body temperature.
Turns out that's a continuity error, too, but oh well. Because you don't have to have the room nearly 98 degrees, because if you're wearing clothing, you're going to be a lot colder on the monitor, whatever. Anyway.
Well, and also that Robert Redford doesn't break a sweat at all when it's 98.6 degrees and he's fully dressed. And why would he need to be fully dressed?
Well, you want to be fully dressed.
At 98.6 degrees?
No, but you're climbing through stuff. I don't know about you, but I would be afraid of like getting stuff snagged. Not that. Although as you get older, anyway, never mind.
So Cosmo needed a box.
Of course, Cosmo needed a box. Okay, so he's going to destabilize the whole world economy, creating anarchy, and his whole. And this is actually a prescient sort of thought too. That, you know, he who controls the information controls the world. That really is very, very true in today's society.
Yeah, we also find out at this point in the movie that not only is Cosmo still alive, but he's never grown up. Sort of his philosophical development was arrested back when he was arrested. So he still has the same sort of hippie idealism about... making everybody equal. So that's what he really wants to do with a piece of hardware.
Though I will say, for someone with such a push for equality and for having everyone on the same social kind of economic status, he had a pretty swank pad. I mean, come on, he had the Nagel paintings on the wall, and everything was kind of cool and blue. And
well, the Nagel painting was Warner Brandis's.
Warner Brandis's.
Yeah, that's okay. True, yeah.
But I mean, just thinking like about his actual office.
Actually, if you put a couple of Nagel paintings in an office, that would have been my dream office at a certain point in my life.
Well, because he had the pictures of the Hindenburg.
Yeah, that was weird.
Disaster.
Like, okay. Yeah.
As he says himself. I'm quoting him.
Excellent.
Disaster, Marty.
Yeah.
It kind of has this, like, you know, like a sassy kind of Yiddish accent to it.
Disaster.
Disaster.
Can you guys do this for the rest of the episode? That'd be great.
We could, except you'll make a song out of it, and we will never hear the end of it.
No. I'm enjoying this. I can't do accents, so I don't even try. No, that's not true. I try, but I can't do it. It's very good, though. I'm impressed by everybody. So Martin gets out of... he's basically dumped off the side of the road. And
after being choked out.
And
on Lombard Street, right?
It certainly looked very close to Lombard Street.
So then he gets taken back, or he goes back to the apartment. And they go to Liz's apartment because it's supposed to be more secure or they're not bugged or whatever.
Well, he goes back to Liz because it's the only person that he thinks he has left safe to go to, where they have that touching moment where he's like, I'm sorry. Now, which is supposed to make up for, like, all the crap of the last, I don't know how many days, where he then, you know, accuses her of outing him.
Well, and what's the age disparity? I'm not, you know, a prude or whatever, but they were dating at one point, right? This is a girlfriend, yeah. Former girlfriend?
Yeah.
Isn't he like 100?
Well, I think chronologically in real time, there's a age difference, but I don't think there's that much of one in the movie.
I think they're meant to be contemporaries in the movie.
Yeah, because is there not, though?
Of course not.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
No, but they got, you know...
It's like wrinkled for her pleasure.
The crow's feet?
Yeah, there
I
you
don't
go.
I get it.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. That's exactly it. Jeez. It's come to this.
Okay, that was the first time I actually broke down, so I...
Okay, well, good. Excellent. So they relocate to Liz's apartment, and they contact the real NSA agent, Abbott.
Right. No. They try their little hacker-style obfuscation of their phone system, so they try.
Yeah, and also the crazy Dan Aykroyd... polygraph
liometer.
Yeah, that was the lamest part of the movie as far as I know.
Well,
he's lying. He's not lying. He's lying. He's not lying.
Well, but you know, you expect that from Dan Aykroyd, crazy.
I guess. And now, is Dan Aykroyd is like, seems like he's channeling himself.
Really? I think the role is him. A role could not have been written better for him because it is him, I think. If anybody has seen him nowadays,
he's pretty
goofy.
And you could see where he would actually come up with all those facts on his own.
And may have ad-libbed all of them.
Exactly.
I just assumed he was the same character from Ghostbusters.
He could have been that too. Yeah. And I was thinking, okay, Matt, was this like a one sort of like role for Dan Aykroyd during that time? No, Dan Aykroyd has worked continuously since Saturday Night Live. I didn't realize it. He's got a very continuous work history.
Yeah, I don't think he turns a lot of things down.
Yeah, well, which is important.
But hey, you know, you can cash the checks.
And he's got skull vodka, something like that?
Right.
And is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it just Canadian or is it American too?
No idea.
It's got the skull bottles.
It's not the kind of vodka I drink, but it is the skull bottle.
It is the bottle I want to have, though. That's important.
If anybody listening would like to send a
bottle. Yeah, exactly. If anybody wants to send gifts to Not in a Creepy Way.
We would mention them.
So now the hijinks are in full throttle here because we've got the lie detector and then we have the fact that they have to fake out all of these things, that all these security devices in Cosmo's office, including a motion detector.
So the result of the phone call to NSA was that the team finds out that there's no way that Bishop's going to be able to go to the NSA to help him out of this jam unless he has the box. So then they have to figure out how to get the box back from Cosmo.
Which is where they determine that Robert Redford really doesn't know where he was. And so they have to kind of try and help him find out where he was, which is where Whistler comes up with the idea of kind of recreating, well, what did it sound like?
Yeah, and Whistler is not only blind, but he is a magician.
Yeah, he's a genius magician who has all kinds of just exact sounds at his disposal.
Yeah, and all sorts of things. He's a magic character.
Yeah, he's basically like blind sound MacGyver.
Anywho, so they go through this whole rigmarole of having him remember exactly where he went, which is a pretty slick trick. And then they bring back the goose thing, which at the time I thought was super clever.
Absolutely, the little misdirection of. It sounds like it, because when you listen to
bring back the goose thing,
it's stolen from another movie.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
What movie?
I will have to look it up, but it is definitely a bringing back thing.
Oh, you're accusing thievery and you don't even have the movie at hand.
In the 1965 thriller Blindfold, Rock Hudson's kidnappers drive him past a lake with a gaggle of geese nearby. He later thinks this is the sound of the guests at a cocktail party until he retraces his route and discovers the actual source of the sounds.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
So Whistler is a Rock Hudson fan.
Exactly. Why wouldn't you be?
Well, he's dead, so.
He used to be a fan of dead people.
It's hard to be.
Look at Jesus. Anyway. So.
And we just lost listeners.
That's okay. If we hadn't lost listeners by this point. Yeah.
So then they get to they finally discover that, oh, there's nothing at the end of this road but private property. Private property.
Zoinks!
New York City! So they discover that the building, which is a toy building, that's no toy building. That's a sinister, evil front. So that's when they decide to set up surveillance around it and kind of discover what exactly is going on.
And what's going on is a lot of security.
Yeah.
Oh, and at one point, doesn't Whistler say, oh, the ultrasonic is just unbelievable?
It's bristling. That room is bristling with ultrasonic.
Yeah. Isn't ultrasonic, you can't hear it because it's ultrasonic? Or am I just...
You can't hear it unless you're blind.
Ah, I got it. Okay.
Excellent. We've established that he is a blind sound MacGyver.
Okay, yes, exactly. So now they have to find a way in here and a way to get past all the security. And they come up with getting past the cutting edge voice recognition.
The man trap.
Yeah. Please explain the man trap.
Well, the man trap is a supposedly steel reinforced box, but which has some kind of glass doors. So not really highly effective for containing people if they really want out. But a door, a cube, if you will, kind of a chamber where one enters with a security card encoded with their voice print. And they have to speak into this box after swiping their card that establishes that they are actually the voice print match to the card, and then that allows them access. So it's a security device.
So the voice print is on the card?
Well, the voice print identifies, well, the voice print is either in the system or is indicated by the card.
It's linked to the card.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because I was just curious, because if the voice print was on the card, that's interesting.
Well, it's encoded somehow to tie the card back to the person. But somewhere the person's voice is encoded somewhere.
Yeah. No, I'm just curious.
I'm having not manufactured the man trap myself, I'm not familiar with how the execution of the actual mechanicals of the man trap.
Oh, I'm sure there's more than one way to trap a man. Baby, by the way, best way to trap a man.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Anyway, so nothing. People.
Don't have any babies. I don't have any reference point.
This kind of stuff is not going to fly with a live studio audience, let me tell you.
Okay. Well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they would laugh relentlessly.
Actually, I have a vision of live studio audience being almost like our juggling at the Elks Club.
We don't talk about juggling.
Okay. All right.
Wow.
Oh, I love that Elks Club story, though.
Did they just walk out?
No, it was children and some guys in Grand Poobah hats.
That sounds creepy.
We could not spend that money fast enough. Let me just point this out.
Okay. So they figure out how to defeat the man trap. They have to send Liz to date the Warner Brandes character, who is just this, I don't know, the epitome of every kind of stereotypical bad introverted programmer that you've ever met, who actually, Travis and I know somebody just like him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, let's just realize that on this program, we don't say bad and introverted together ever.
Okay, well, that's true.
Because it's discriminatory.
Well, and because we're all introverted anyway, so.
No, as it turns out, not. Agoraphobic, maybe. Introverted, not so much.
So, Liz has to try and get Warner to say all the words so that they can get, you know, a voice print to get in through the man trap. So,
which is a fun scene. You have to admit it is.
Well, the dim sum bar with the Leroy Brown badly in English in the background.
It was pointed out in the trivia that, what is her name in the computer dating world?
Doris.
And what is the girl who Leroy Brown gets in trouble for in the song?
Doris.
Also Doris. Yes. So.
Kind of a callback.
Yeah, kind of fun. Yeah. You know, and actually, Stephen Tobolowsky says that the director said, "Do whatever you want, say whatever you want, just to try to make her laugh."
Well, and he says some of the most cringe-inducing, cringe-inducing line of the movie when he tries to do his smooth jazz line like, "Would you like to have breakfast with me?" And she's like, "Yeah, sure, whatever." And it's like, "Should I phone you or nudge you?"
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, oh, I just wanted to take a shower, scrub myself. It was just gross. But so through whatever subterfuge Liz tries with the, "Oh, there's this one word I want you to say." And, oh,
it just makes her hot.
Well, maybe for you. It was just cringe-inducing for me.
No, but it's the word that just turns her on.
Whore.
So, I thought the word was passport.
So that's why I had some problems with the continuity in this movie, is because they were trying to get that all together, but it's hard to tell where that jumps back and forth in the movie because
I just thought that was all the same date why they were making chicken again.
That was two dates.
Was it two dates?
Definitely two dates.
That's my point. So they're desperately trying to get the tape together for the man trap. And I'm going to say that as much as possible.
Yeah, so they had to get the audio so that then they could splice it together. And then when they were actually going to go do the heist, she had to have another date so that she could slip the card out.
Okay, I got it. Okay, so somewhere I missed that part, and I apologize to her anyway.
But it gave us more Tobolowsky, so that was great.
It does,
It did. It made him into this badass mean man, though, too.
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah.
When he was like, "Let's go for a drive."
Yeah. Care to go for a drive, Doris?
Oh, yeah, exactly. When he finally onto her, because the cat knocks the bag over or something, or
little
he knocks,
Poochie,
yeah,
Poochie.
Which was
a brilliant part of the movie. I thought, by the way, a brilliant way to kind of give the tell was, you know, she asks to use the phone, and when he's talked about the little Poochie, about he's made the voice activated robot, and she has to use the phone. She asks where it is, and he says, well, you walk right down the hall or walk forward and whatever.
For some reason, the only phone he has in his house is in the bedroom.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Well, phone her or nudge her. So,
yeah, so I'm assuming he ripped all the phones out of his house.
Yeah,
what a better way to before she came over.
What a better way to trap a woman in your room.
Yeah, either way.
In 1992.
Yeah, either way, I'll be naked.
The only way to call for help is from my bedroom. You know, he said, you know, I think she asked where the phone is. He says, you know, walk forward down the hall or whatever. And of course, that makes the pooch activated because it's voice activated, which then knocks her purse off, which conveniently dumps out her wallet with her actual real name on it.
But also the list of words, right? Or just her name?
No, I think you just see her ID. And he's suspicious because he sees her ID, you know, because, oh, you know, the name doesn't match.
And he's got 180 IQ, so he starts to put it together.
That's true. That is his personal plane.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Which is when they go for a ride.
Oh, yeah. And he is kind of menacing.
Well, yeah. You think he's seemingly a little high-strung and possibly easily untethered.
Yeah. I mean, mine wasn't that he was menacing from the standpoint of, like, being a bad guy. It was more of this, like, well, she's trying to steal my designs. Like, when they get back to the office, that's what he's concerned about is her trying to somehow steal his toy designs, which I thought kind of it added to that kind of innocent, almost autistic presentation.
So they're actually making toys?
He actually was making toys.
In his office. Yeah, he made that dog.
Well, okay, I understand, but it just occurred to me that,
that dog was a toy.
Thank you, yes. That's good to know. Thank you. I appreciate that. But I'm thinking, I mean, if Paytronics was in the front for anything, if they're really making toys.
Well, no, I think that...
Well, it had to have some legitimacy to it so that it didn't just fall into the pressure of its own lies.
But why would you hire some 180 IQ guy to make a toy
because
it's a front?
Because his specialty is voice recognition. And if you're doing spy operations, that's what I would want. I would want someone who was really smart who could develop chips and computers and stuff like that
that. The question is now, does Stephen Tobolowsky know he's a bad guy?
I don't think so. Which I think kind of made him endearing.
Yeah, I think that was Cosmo's front, but only Cosmo really knew what was going on.
And Wallace and the other.
So Cosmo is basically doing the same sort of trick as Liz, trying to get him to do stuff for the wrong purposes?
Yes.
Okay. Because now I'm
Cosmo like every evil owner of a corporation.
Well, I suppose, but you'd think that your employees would know what you were doing at least a little bit.
Well, not necessarily. Not if you're an evil genius.
Well, maybe I guess if you're going to.
That's why they're employees and not owners.
I mean, if you listen to Steve Jobs' autobiography, they even talk about how like a lot of employees didn't even know what they were working on, and had no idea what their work was going into until the very end. So,
mind blown. Obviously, my personal plate is something like 78 IQ.
Well, that's okay.
At least I get those special tags.
You're a bad man.
No. You know what? It's not fun to make. It's not acceptable to make fun of handicapped people. I'm just saying.
They're differently abled.
I know. They're differently tarded. It's back to the plot.
Nice. Did this movie come out before or after Mission Impossible?
They actually mentioned the Mission Impossible TV show a lot in any of the positive reviews of the movie. They said, you know, if you grew up watching the Mission Impossible TV show, that you'd like this.
Really?
Yeah, because there was always, you know, some computer guy or technology expert to save the day at the end, except this movie is full of those guys.
Oh, well, very good. So... they basically, Robert Red, or Martin's character gets into Cosmo's office after Carl jacks up the heat to 1.5 million degrees.
98.6.
He has to go real slow from Dan Aykroyd's perspective.
What, 3 miles an hour? 2 miles an hour?
It was so many meters per second. So I'm American, so I can't do that math in my head. You know, he had to walk real slow and get the box, which then, of course, Werner comes back with Liz and makes a big scene because, of course, you stole my card too, which except that, like, if she'd stole the card and he was with her, wouldn't she have the card on her?
That's true. You know what? I'm going to pause this for just a second because we're getting to a good part. Werner finds out that Doris is really Liz and he is pissed. He's going to drag her back to...
And does, in fact, drive her back.
Yeah, sorry. He drives her back to Playtronics.
Yeah, so Werner figures this out at the same time that the rest of the gang is in full heist mode. They're breaking into the building. They're making progress. So by the time Werner gets there, Martin actually has the box in hand. They've defeated all the security, and you know they're just a couple minutes away from getting out clean. When Werner shows up with Liz and starts to muck things up by making a scene at security.
And now tell me again why Martin is going instead of, say, Carl?
Because Kreese is a dick.
Well, because nobody else wanted to do it because it was potentially dangerous. And so they were like, not it.
Well, I suppose. Yeah, I guess it's his baby, so he should do it. But it seems like Carl, who's young and thin.
Well, but also Martin's been in the office before, so he already knows the layout.
Okay,
he's the only one who's actually seen it.
Okay, asked and answered.
So and a confrontation between Cosmo and Carl at the end wouldn't be nearly as emotionally satisfying.
Well, that's true. Yeah, there is that. Anyway, so Werner drags Liz up to the front desk and says that there's something going on.
Who then gets the whole cavalcade cast of stars involved because Buddy and what's his face? I don't know the Timothy Busfield character's name, but the two NSA wannabe lackeys. Mm-hmm. Pretenders show up, and then Ben Kingsley shows up. You know, Cosmo shows up.
The name you're thinking for of is Dick.
Oh, that's right,
Dick Gordon.
Yes, right. Dick Gordon.
But yeah,
I can tell you what a comfort that is, Dick.
Yeah, Cosmo has the badass remote control that defeats all security in the entire building.
Magic
door open. Yeah, so he's just walking through, clicking and clicking and clicking. So maybe it would have been much easier just to steal that thing.
We can think, yeah, that's a good point there.
I'd also like to point out, when he walks into the room and he's like, why is it so warm in here? And then just keeps on walking. Like, 98.6 degrees, you would just kind of assume it'd be hotter than that.
It would be pretty tropical.
For him, it's just kind of like, it's warmer in here than usual.
Well, hold on. We've got probably my favorite point in the movie we just skipped right over. Cosmo then ends up talking, or stopping with Buddy and Dick, and talking to Liz and Werner. That's when he finds out that it was supposed to be a computer date, and then he, using his keen powers of reasoning, he realizes no computer would set you up with him.
In theory.
Yes. But that's not the point that I loved. The point that I loved is when he immediately finds out there's probably Martin doing something, he turns and he does this little skip hop. Did you guys catch that?
Yeah, he's excited.
He is sprightly. He is like cat-like.
Very much so.
Yeah.
But also, this is the point where Werner gets murdered off screen.
Exactly.
Right?
he's just gone.
Poor Werner.
Because everybody else comes rushing in, but he's just poof, vanished.
Yeah, well,
like
you know.
Vapor.
Then our, I guess now Dick and Buddy, are they supposed to be like security people?
Yes.
They're goons. Henchman.
Yeah, Buddy. Okay, he may have gone through henchman school and passed with flying colors, but he obviously does not work in maintenance. Because at one point, he tracks down Martin by just blindly shooting his shotgun into the ceiling.
Right.
Now, okay, so this is a toy company, whatever. International,
House of Spies.
Yeah. So think of the just the infrastructure that involves, I don't know, security or, technology. But also, what about, like, water and sewer? Well, he's just indiscriminately shooting up into the ceiling.
Also, after the point that Cosmo tells them all to go up into the ceiling and start checking for people, so he doesn't know he's not shooting one of his own people.
Well, there's that, too.
But I also get the impression he doesn't care.
Well, no, but how embarrassing. What, no, sprinklers?
He's the same kind of moron henchman that would throw Axel Foley through the window of their own building.
Mm-hmm. Point taken.
Yeah. Nice dramatic effect to kind of, you know, have exposition of the shotgun after the shotgun after the shotgun blast with as you know, Travis pointed out, with the Robert Redford earpiece that is broadcasting at, you know, stadium levels.
Yeah, well, yeah. So Cosmo goes into his room, find out it is very warm, but continues on, and then opens up the answering machine box. Why do they leave this thing in the answering machine box when they're in the big security thing also?
Well, it makes it nondescript.
But just laying on a desk? Well, do you think there'd be a safe?
No, answering machines sit on desks.
Okay, I understand.
Hide in plain sight.
It doesn't work unless it's in the answering machine box.
I guess, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, Panasonic needed the advertising.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe they paid some sort of product placement fee.
There you go.
So then we find out the box is empty. Martin's got the box. Or somebody's got the box.
And Cosmo loses his shit.
Yes, he flips his chicken, as Connie would say. And he's a sprightly angry man now.
Yes.
And this is where, of course, shots being fired into the ceiling, all that stuff. And then there's the final, what, confrontation? Right. Well, no, not quite.
Well, yeah, I mean, so he basically Robert Redford gives up and comes down and gets taken back to...
Because Cosmo threatens to kill Liz, who he has kidnapped while they murdered Werner.
That's true.
Right, and says, you know, I cannot kill my friend.
One of the greatest parts of that movie, actually.
Yeah, where he has the speech on the phone.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and he convinces, and Robert Redford, you know, Martin decides he's going to, okay, well, it's Liz, and that's my fault again, my bad. So he goes back to, basically gets dragged back to the office with Buddy, or Buddy dragging him either way, to rescue Liz.
Which is like the most Redford moment of the whole movie.
Where they reunite.
Yeah, because he just shows up and just kind of shrugs his shoulders like, yeah, no, well, it's a good run.
Yeah, having a good day? Well, yeah. You know, it was great. Again, one of those great character actor moments where they're, you know, they're, the facial expression, it's all in the facial expression. So, which then Cosmo, you know, is like, well, you know, I cannot kill my friend. Kill my friend. Which is exactly what you expected all along, by the way. Like, had expected that to happen entirely, so.
It's such a, like, a Dr. Evil arch-villain kind of line.
So then it's, you know, then truly the, what you don't see going on in the background is that Kreese and, was it Kreese and Mother?
Yes.
Kreese and Mother are at the van with Whistler, and some of Cosmo's henchmen have found the van and confronted them, and so now Whistler and Kreese, or I'm sorry, Mother and Kreese have been removed from the van, but Whistler is hidden in the back of the van.
Well, hold on. During that scene where Mother and Kreese are removed from the van, one of the security guards, I believe he calls Kreese Midnight?
Midnight.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's not what you call Sidney Poitier, ever. No.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
But at least we get to find out why he was kicked out of the CIA.
Yes.
Because apparently he has a bad temper.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that nobody in the CIA has a bad temper.
Yeah. This is where I think actually the scene where he ends up, escaping from the bad guys is where they throw a couple of, like, I don't know if it's an F-bomb or some kind of swearing in there.
Yeah.
Which they did on purpose because otherwise this movie was headed for a G rating. And they figured nobody would go to a G-rated movie.
Well, I don't think they would have gotten a G-rating with the two murder executions. The two executions.
Well, okay, there's that.
I don't know about the MPA, but I think...
Or Robert Redford saying, you know, you should give him head whenever he wants.
Well,
let's
yeah.
Let's not forget that line.
That's true, yes.
PG-13, maybe.
Be a beacon.
So then we have some hilarity. Not only the Midnight thing causing... Sidney Poitier's eye to start twitching and him to go into full Hulk mode. But then we have the hilarity of Whistler getting orders to drive the truck.
After Robert Redford, Martin has helped the escape with Carl breaking through the ceiling and beating the crap out of Buddy and Dick.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
yeah, I really hated the Whistler driving scene. I mean, you just knew when you saw a blind dude in the van, you just knew at some point he was going to be driving that van, and it was supposed to be hilarious. And it really fell flat for me until the very end of that scene.
Where he hits the wall, mm-hmm. which is the best scene.
Yeah, where Martin's counting down how many seconds he should keep going before he hits the brakes, and he grossly underestimates... So Whistler crashes into the wall, and that's how he ends up stopping.
Okay, stop.
That was funny.
Yeah. I thought so. Yeah, I thought that actually the whole thing was kind of charming.
But also, Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder.
Well, yeah. Well, again, blind guy, it's the blind guy tropes, right, out of the blind guy handbook.
Basically, the final confrontation
on the roof with Cosmo and Martin kind of having their discussion about how they've changed and, you know, how they haven't really lived up. Clearly they haven't lived up to each other's expectations. In which, you know, they have that where Martin ends up giving him the box back. And then, you know, he's like, I'm going to escape and I'm going to go down here and you're going to have to kill me yourself.
And of course, Cosmo can't.
Of course not. But then the reveal that, oh, you've been double-crossed again because you got the facsimile box that I was practicing with, which actually didn't have anything in it, while I have the real box in my backpack.
Because Martin was clever enough to carry that with him the entire time just for this very situation.
Exactly.
Of course.
See, I kind of got the feeling that he was carrying that facsimile box because he was going to swap them out in the office. So when he didn't and he just left the box blank, I was like, well, if you would have put it back, he would have checked and gone, oh, okay, the box is still here. No one stole anything. It seemed like a wasted moment.
But he didn't have time to leave it there because he had to get out quickly because of Warner, right?
Well, he had to walk slowly across the carpet back to get out quickly. So true. He could have just swapped the box. I mean, that would have only added like a second, maybe.
You're right. This movie's shit.
So, but also, he could have immediately gone over the edge of the building and shot him. Like, there was such little time passing between, you know, Martin sliding down the ladder and, you know, him discovering that he had the empty box. Except the cutaway in the movie was like, they're speeding out of the parking lot all of a sudden after this vehicle that just slammed headfirst into a wall.
Yeah, there's that problem.
So, clearly there were no airbags, but it seems to function just fine after just running headlong into a wall.
Maybe it's one of those after rear radiator cars.
After having the rear radiator with the back doors of the van open?
I'm just saying.
And somehow Whistler's face wasn't caved in by the steering wheel.
Exactly, yeah. Since he has no idea it's coming, he cannot brace himself because he is blind. So yeah, he should have hit that steering wheel or that windshield hard.
Well, and the fact that it had jumped a bunch of curbs and hit vehicles on the way en route.
Well, there's that. Yeah, and the fact that that truck never would have jumped all those curbs, do you think?
Not more than one.
No, it seems...
It did.
Well, there you go. Sorry.
God. So then they make their escape, and they have the box, and they head back to their offices. At which point, surprise...
Darth Vader is waiting for them.
Right. Yes. The Dark Lord.
Yeah, and his team of stormtroopers.
Which is when the team basically gets to make their deal, when they admit they have the box, but they're not giving the box to Mr. Abbott.
Now, why didn't they just shoot them and take the box? They're the NSA, they should have shot them all.
The NSA doesn't do that. That's the CIA. Okay.
Sorry, it's the...
No, remember, it's the FBI in tunnels.
Well, there was that joke through the whole thing of like, no, you're thinking of the CIA. No, that's the FBI.
Right.
You know, we're the TSA.
Almost in Clue fashion.
With the NSA.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It seems like all this haggling that could have been easily avoided by the girl with the machine gun spraying them.
Bullet to the head.
But if we didn't have this scene, we would have never gotten this exact same scene in Armageddon a few years later.
It's very sad. Very, very sad. So, each of the characters get their own quirky rewards from the government, or
except for Liz, who opts out.
Which is kind of dumb. I mean, she could have had anything she wanted.
Well, she got Robert Redford.
Yeah, the only thing that really got anything of any value is his mother. Well, I guess, Martin got his name back, but...
Yeah, Kreese got that trip.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Sorry, forgot about Kreese.
Yeah, because Whistler was just stupid.
Peace on Earth. Just try.
That never
happened. Well, because he's magic. He doesn't need anything else. He can freaking forge anything out of his, like, magic dead eyes.
I did appreciate the snarky comment about geography, though. When he's like, Tahiti's not in Europe. And he's like, when you have the box, you can school us on geography.
Yeah.
He's like, yes.
They're American.
Yeah. Oh, no. It was a funny ending. Don't get me wrong. I liked it. But yeah, it was sort of a Gene Wilder kind of ending.
Exactly.
It was a little shocking. You know, that was... however it came off, it was supposed to be a pretty heavy scene between Martin and Cosmo, the way they left it. And then they came back to have Abbott, played by James Earl Jones, and have a really lighthearted sort of epilogue.
And Cosmo with no retribution.
Until the sequel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what happened to the sequel? Why was there no sequel? So do you want to hear some of what Stephen Tobolowsky had to say about the filming of this?
Sure.
He says that during part of the big action finale, Robert Redford is chased through a secret lab by all the bad guys. The director was choreographing the chase and tried to put them in some kind of order of how fast they're running. Then he said, let's do it this way. Ben, you're the Academy Award winner. We'll start with you. Then Tim, the Emmy winner, you'll be next. Do we have a Tony winner? Anyway, Stephen, you'll be last.
Redford's never won anything, has he?
You think he would have been nominated for Butch Cassidy, no?
I think he's been nominated. I don't think he's ever won.
Oh, well, maybe that's it.
It's an honor just to be nominated.
I think Redford falls into the same sort of Tom Cruise kind of category, where maybe not the best actor out there, but just a bona fide movie star.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
So he's sort of playing Robert Redford in every movie he's in, but he's so compelling to watch.
I would disagree with that only from watching All the President's Men.
You don't think he was compelling in that?
I think he was very compelling.
Oh, you think he was
playing,
a bit...
I don't think he was playing himself. But that was also a very, very young, probably very hungry Robert Redford.
And he's done a lot of different things, too. I mean, again, like 3 Days of the Condor and stuff, that was, you know, that was much more dramatic than this was.
And that Brad Pitt movie he did where he was a CIA guy.
Yeah, that was a weird...
I can't remember the name of that now, but...
Ultimately forgettable.
Spy Game. I like that movie.
I thought it was a perfectly enjoyable movie.
Saw it at the theater. I don't know.
I think we may have all seen that one together, too.
It's possible. Anyway, Tobolowsky also says that years later he ran into the director and writer at a symphony. He asked him how he was able to come up with such a great script. The director then blushed and said he'd worked on it for 9 years. And here's where the Tobolowsky wisdom goes. He says, I know spending a long time writing something doesn't guarantee success, but not giving up on a good idea almost always does.
Oh, well, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
How much did this movie make? Did it?
$100 million.
Wow.
And it was
wow.
And it was a $50 million cast.
Wow.
Or sorry, that's so Freudian because I'm sure the cast had a lot to do with it. Yeah, it was the budget was about 50, and it made 100, so that works. And that was just domestic or
100 million in 92. That's a pretty good.
Yeah.
Good return.
Yep. And I guess once they got Redford signed in, that's how the rest of the cast.
Oh.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, River Phoenix.
Well, that's a question I had, too. Why is River Phoenix held up as such a great, or his death was such a great loss? Is this the James Dean effect, where he did a couple of things that were kind of good?
I think he did things that were marginally good, and people thought that he was going to be the next greatest thing. They expected, you know, great things from him because the people saw potential, that, you know, that nebulous potential. And then, you know, of course, he died. So they were like, well.
What was he in that?
My Own Private Idaho.
Yeah. Which is where I think most people thought, you know, he's going to go places.
Yeah. A couple of other things, but that was basically the big one, I think. Yeah,
My Own Private Idaho is what everybody was acclaiming him for. They were, you know, they thought, wow, this is going to be a big star someday.
And he's from the whole Wingnut family of stars, so.
They're a little different. He's not one of the Culkins, so.
Well, yeah, but you never knew. Like, actually, it's funny because do you think, oh no, he was in Stand By Me also.
River Phoenix?
Yeah.
I'm not remembering him in Stand By Me.
He was the cool one of their gang. The one that was smart but was never going to make it because of his family. He was Kiefer Sutherland's brother, pretty sure. We have the IT department working on it.
He was in Little Nikita. He was in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, The Mosquito Coast, Stand By Me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Who is he in Indiana Jones?
He was Indiana Jones.
I think he was Indiana
Jones.
Yeah,
he was young Indy.
He played the young Indy?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay.
That was at the beginning of The Last Crusade, right?
Yeah. Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, the TV series.
I know. We're going to have to tackle Seven Brides for Seven Brothers because that is a messed up script, at least.
Yeah, he was in some movies, I think, but My Own Private Idaho was what everybody, I think, thought that he was, that was going to be the next greatest big vehicle launching point where he was going to have some blossoming somewhere.
He was going to win the Academy Award that his brother Leaf finally won.
Leaf Phoenix?
Yeah, wasn't Joaquin, didn't he used to be Leaf?
Yeah, in Parenthood, he was credited under a different name.
Yeah.
I don't remember. Was it Leaf?
I'm pretty sure it was Leaf. L-E-A-F.
I can't imagine why you would change that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To Joaquin.
Well, because fucked up face Phoenix was taken by the Screen Actors Guild.
Easy. He's handsome enough to be a movie star.
Oh, he is. Yeah. Also, Hair Lip Jones taken.
Strangely enough, there is a 2012 entry for River Phoenix.
Archive footage?
From a movie called Dark Blood.
Maybe he's a hologram like Tupac.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It sounds good. He also died before he had a chance to screw anything up, though.
That's true, too.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah. Except for that one drug thing, that one night.
Well, no. I mean more of like when you have famous musical artists who die at 28, it's like they haven't had a chance to put out something really bad to tarnish their record just yet.
They don't have the...
He hadn't Ishtar'd himself.
Or he hadn't Bill Murray Garfield'd himself.
Yeah, but how much money did Bill Murray get for Garfield?
Oh, he probably made a lot of money for Garfield. Yeah, and why not? He's Bill freaking Murray. He can do whatever he wants. So, anything else? Would you recommend it? Is it still on your list of judgment?
Absolutely. It's a fun movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you can pick it up and watch it at any time, and it's still a fun movie. I mean, even rewatching it, I see things. So,
I love this movie.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect like Sunday afternoon movie.
Absolutely.
It's the kind of movie that if it happens to be on TV when you're flipping channels, you can just kiss the next hour of your life goodbye.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So any other thoughts about this or anything else?
Not that come to mind.
Nope.
So what did we decide we're going to watch next for next week?
We're going to watch Roadhouse. We'd like to thank our special guest, Travis. Thank you, Travis.
My pleasure to be here.
Excellent.
And you'll be hearing us in the same room again for the next week?
Yeah, I hope so. That would be nice. I'll just leave the stuff as is.
Yeah, that's exactly the smartest thing you could do.
Well, what? Somebody going to steal it like a purse? There's no cats.
There's a dog.
There's a dog.
You think the dog will eat my stuff?
I don't know.
I wouldn't be concerned about eating it so much as pulling it off the pool table.
Oh, there's that. I suppose I could unplug
it from... Maybe drag it around a little bit.
Slobber on it.
Lots of slobber.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. If you have a rant or rave, please send your emails to rants@notincreepyway.com.
Like us on Facebook. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Leave a comment. Turns out you can leave a 5-star rating and the comment could say your show sucks. And it still makes us happy.
Not in a Creepy Way.